we are all dependent and potentially addicted as well, because we regularly use addictive objects whenever we are confronted with a circumstance that brings a lot of pain, emotional pain, more pain than we can bear.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my two guests today are Dr. Claudio Spadazzi from Rome and Dr. Jose Zussman from Rio de Janeiro. And it's a special pleasure for me to welcome them both on this podcast for a couple of reasons. First, the three of us work together on the IPA and Health Committee, and we're sort of old friends from that work. I've also had the pleasure of interviewing each of them previously. There is a sister podcast to the one you're listening to, and as Claudia is not only a practicing psychoanalyst, but she's also a practicing gynecologist, and she and I had a conversation on this other podcast on the treatment of psychogenic amenorrhea. And there's a link to that conversation on these show notes. And today we're talking about her chapter called Pornography, Psychoanalysis, and Affective Neuroscience, which was part of a book entitled Neuropsychoanalysis of the Inner Mind, a Biological Understanding of Human Mental Function. And I'm also talking with Jose Zussman, who I also interviewed before, and it was on his work with addictions. And it's from the current chapter he has called How a Lack of Human Connection May Lead to Dehumanization and Addiction. And it's a particular pleasure because that chapter is part of a book that was just recently published entitled Applying Psychoanalysis in Medical Care. And it is the first of a series of the IPA in the Community book series. And this is put out by our IPA in Health Committee. I'm unabashedly proud of this work. I do note that all royalties from the book go to the IPA, and it contains chapters on how one can reach medical patients by bringing a psychoanalytic point of view to the encounter. There are chapters by scholars and clinicians in the field, from palliative care to cancer patients to pediatric patients and eating disorder patients. There's a chapter on balance groups. There's a number of really beautifully written papers, and I hope the listeners find it of interest. Let me tell you a little bit about the credentials of each of them, and then what we'll be discussing. Dr. Spadazzi is a physician, a clinical psychologist, a gynecologist, a sex therapist. He's a full member of the Italian Psychoanalytic Society and the IPA, International Psychoanalytic Association. She's been active as part of the IPA, has been on a number of committees, IPSO, COAP, Public Information, CAPSA, and as I mentioned, our Health Committee. She's the co-founder of the Italian Psychoanalytic Dialogues, founder of Freud's Bar, an outreach initiative, founder of the section of cinema and psychoanalysis at the Festival of the Two Worlds in Spoleto. And Dr. Zussman is a president and training analyst at the Rio de Janeiro Psychoanalytic Society. He did a postdoc at the Institute of Psychiatry of the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro and Harvard under the mentorship of Edward Catsion. As I said, he's with us on the IPA Health Committee, and he's the chair of the IPA Subcommittee on Education. I learned a great deal from our conversation and their writings, and I hope you find it as valuable as I have. Claudia and Jose, welcome. Welcome back to the podcast. It's good to have you here again. We're going to be discussing today addictive pornography, focusing on both the addictive parts of it and the pornographic parts of it. And you've each written about this, and you've written about it from somewhat different perspectives, though overlapping. Claudia, in your chapter, you focused on the prevalence of the condition and also how it lives in the mind and in the brain. And Jose, you've continued your work writing about the developmental origins of addictive behavior. And also, most crucially, and in a very alive way, you've written about how it makes its presence known in the clinical situation between patient and analyst. But to start off with, Claudia, with your chapter, there were two sentences that jumped out at me that I thought would be a good place for us to begin. The first is, you write, quote, "About 30% of the words typed on the internet are related to pornography." Now, let me read that again, because I had to read it and read it over again to believe it. About 30% of the words typed on the internet are related to pornography. And the second sentence that jumped out at me that led me to think that it could be useful for us to have this conversation. You write that contemporary psychoanalysis does not seem to take enough into account the profoundly transformative effects of pornography. Claudia, tell us about this.
I would like to start with something that Billie Eilish said in these days. She's a pop star, she's a singer, and she says she's very young, she's around her 20s, and she said, "I've been devastated by looking at the pornography on internet all my life since I was 11 years old." Huh. And I think that this is very interesting, first of all, because Billie is a girl, and this is quite a different perspective about pornography. And then, because this idea of devastation, she says, "I've been devastated." I think this is a very interesting point of view, because I think that pornography can be devastating. And if we think to the amount of viewers of pornography in the world, we know that, for example, in the United States, we have 100 million viewers per day on the pornography.
Wait a second, let me make sure I heard that right. 100 million viewers a day in the United States watch pornography.
Exactly. Yeah, and we don't know, we have no data about Muslim countries and in all those countries where pornography is not permitted, but the use and abuse of pornography is also enormous. And we don't know at all about China. So we know only about the Western countries, but the data are really striking and really terrifying, I think.
And did she go on to describe what the setting was that she was devastated by? It was she was introduced it by family members, by friends. What in her led her to do that? Because the patients I've seen, the women who had this early exposure, we're really struggling. Maybe it goes without saying. We're struggling with a host of internal and familial matters. And this was sort of a final common pathway of trying to cope.
Well, from new data, it seems that 11 is the age in which there is the first exposure to pornography, mainly at school, because schoolmates show, or sometimes in the family, sometimes is a pop-up on the internet. Anyway, it's very precocious, the age of the exposition, and I think it's very traumatic for several reasons. And if we had time, of course, we can discuss about it. But this traumatic experience can sometimes meet some inner need, and this can create a kind of cage in which the person is entrapped.
And as you write in your chapter, that certainly matches my clinical experience, where these young women, when they become of sexual mature age, have a great deal of difficulty combining affection and arousal, that they don't live in their minds as related to each other.
Yeah, this combination can be a problem, but we are anyway speaking about of a small amount of user of pornography, because the great amount is, of course, of young men, or anyway adult men, compared to women.
And in your chapter, you describe what we're going to also hear about from Jose, about the disconnect from object longing.
Yeah.
And how that really interferes with development. And you do focus on young men, how it leads to chronic, compulsive, and for our purposes today, addictive masturbation, and how that just plays havoc with development.
Yeah.
You have a quote that you bring forward that I had never put the two together, but it spoke to me as well, how the disconnect from the object, the narcissistic preoccupation of this addictive pornography, makes sublimation more elusive. It doesn't, that we need the tension of struggling with objects and how they live in our lives, and what we mean to them and what they mean to us. We need that struggle in order to find a resolution in sublimation, so that we can go on and be creative. And otherwise, as you write very beautifully, we stay stuck. Tell us something about the neuroscience that you've researched.
Well, to make it simple, we can say that there is a kind of there is a loss of the balance between some emotional system. If we think to affective neurosciences and to the basic emotional system, the primary emotional systems, we can see that there is a kind of loss of this balance, because there is an enormous increase of the dopaminergic seeking system, and there is a predominance of the system. So the person is always looking for the substance in the case of addiction. But in this case, as we are speaking of pornography, of the internet, a view of this particular scene, which have the power of excite the person and to meet let's say his or her inner world. There is this need of seeing and seeing again and again the scene which is able to produce the excitement and to bring to the satisfaction. And so there is this predominance of the seeking system, and there is it's strange to say, but the lust system, which is the system which is linked to the sexual arousal and the excitement and the pleasure, it's somehow secondary. It's very it has a minor involvement, because in fact, situation of masturbation with pornography is not so linked to the body. It's not a bodily excitement. Somehow we can say that there is a reversal. So we have, instead of a down top situation, which means that from the body and from the energy and the person and the hormonal and the other stimulation, for example, the tactile or the bodily excitement, then it brings to the mental excitation. Here we have a reserve, so we have a top-down situation. So we first have the visual excitement and then it goes to the body. And this is a very particular situation which is linked to this kind of stimulation. Of course, pornography is an ancient habit, and it is a tradition since the time of the Romans or even before. But it's very different. Pornography linked to, for example, a book or images like newspapers or even the video. The one on the internet is always, always available, and it is limitless. And this is what gives the feature of addiction, because there is always the hint to look more, to look harder, to look stronger seen, to look on and on and on. It's very interesting because the DSM connects and recognizes an addiction only to the gambling and not to pornography, which is quite peculiar, because I think that it is very important, the pathologic structure of the internet addiction, especially among young men.
You and I had a conversation about that. I had mentioned, as many of our listeners know, about the images in Pompeii, which are essentially pornographic images, in referring to the long history of this. And you felt that there was an important difference to be made between those images and what's now on the internet. Could you explain that?
Well, I think that in the past, as I was mentioning, looking at images or journals or newspapers and this kind of stuff, there is an active possibility to work through these images and through one's own fantasies. While pornography, and this is its enormous power and the way that is connected to so many people, and there is such an enormous amount of money behind this traffic. And the problem is that it's something in front of which the person is always passive. So as we know that the desire of pornography is something linked to some traumatic experience of the person, and the individual is trying to meet something very painful inside his mind, then this passivity the person can meet these images and can be somehow trapped in this scene that he has the need to see more and more.
Mm-hmm. This leads into, Jose, your work and your chapter, which you wrote with your mentor, Edward Cancian. And it's worth mentioning that this is the last thing he wrote before he died this past year. And to start us off, let me just read this sentence in your opening lines. Addiction appears whenever human dependence fails. The failure in question is related to a systematic lack of human connection, and consequently, the use of a specific primitive composite ego defense known as dehumanization, where the relation with non-human components may prevail over human bonds. Tell us about this, Jose.
Well, I'd like to add something more to what you said, because I think it's very important. I state that we are all dependent and potentially addicted as well, because we regularly use addictive objects whenever we are confronted with a circumstance that brings a lot of pain, emotional pain, more pain than we can bear. So we recur to the addictive objects to survive. So addiction is not for the addict. It's not a bad thing. He's not trying to destroy himself. He's trying to survive. So the point is that once you get to the what I call the addiction axis, he doesn't think about the consequences, because everything is for now. Everything, there's no preoccupation about the future. It doesn't exist. So that's why he keeps on repeating, because the addictive object, it may be a behavior or any object, it will work at first to diminish the pain the addict is feeling. But at the same time, it puts the person in question in a position where there's no space for dreams. There's no space for relationship with other people. There's no space for planning a life. It's not that the person is forced to do that. As I said before, he had at the beginning, and for the addict, that's a good thing, because it gets him away from the pain. And that's what the analyst group has to understand, that we're dealing with something that it has presents itself as a good thing, because they can't stand being close to other people. They see people as the bad part of the story. And being away from people seems to be something good. So, and there's another thing. I'm talking about analysts. It's painful for the analyst to be objectified, because that's what the addict will do with the analyst. But it's also painful for the analyst. It's also painful for the addict to be humanized, because he doesn't have experience with that. And mostly, I think, because of the first introjects that they should have inside of them, but they either don't have or have a damaged introject, so that they can't relate to other people and they don't see that as a good thing.
The way you say that in your chapter, you write, addiction emerges as a desperate strategy to manage the dehumanized and impoverished conditions in which a person loses their self-esteem and compassion, caring little for others or themselves.
That's it.
So we can say that it is a self-healing tentative, right?
It is. It is a self-healing strategy. No doubt about that. And I can quote Kenz Young. He says it,
yes.
Put it beautifully, and it's when he says that there is an enormous suffering at the heart of the addictive disorders. The worst fate, however, is not the suffering. The worst fate is suffering alone. So the addict is very lonely. When Claudia, with a beautiful study about pornography, mentions that there's no relationship and there's no feelings with the pornography scene. And I thought myself that she mentions that there's only image, and she's right, because most of the hard pornography stuff doesn't even have a content, only images. So there's no story.
Yeah,
doesn't have to have a story, just sex. So two strange people meet and have sex immediately. And there's no story.
Claudia, you were going to add something?
Yeah, these people in front of their screen, they are terribly alone. I mean, it's something so desperate and so sad. And I think that about pornography, but also about substance addiction, I think that it would should be more understood that these people are suffering and they are so alone and they are trying to taking care of themselves. I think that generally speaking, people are not aware. They usually look with great suspect and sometimes with hate to people who are substance addicted. And I think that it is a great mistake because they really need compassion.
Let me ask a question. I'm thinking of patients I've seen who would meet the criteria for addictive pornography. And the way they were able to fill out their lives and leave it behind wasn't by focusing on the pornography itself, but by focusing on their overall object restriction. That is, that they weren't present in the office. And as the obstacles to their being more fully related in the office, as it took shape and as they blossomed into that, they would say, oh, I don't want to do that anymore. And it wasn't from attending to it directly. Does that match your sense of things, both of you?
Well, I think it does. I think it does. Because there is a lonely feeling, very painful, that the addict lives with. So it behaves like it was something that was not in his hand. He wants to get off of it. He says, so I'm going to stop. I'm not going to do it again. But then to be able to stop that, he has to acquire some kind of instruments, mental instruments, to face intimacy, to face the world. And that's very hard for them. So I think they, at moments, really want to stop it. But they have nothing. If they have nothing to put in its place, they won't manage to do that. So when the mental pain, the emotional pain comes back again, they'll use the pornography as the addict behavior as they did in the past. So the important thing in that, in the relationship with the analyst, is that they can interject a good figure, and then with that figure inside of the person, they have a chance to try and create their own inner resources so they can face the world.
And you write, the challenge for the analyst is as follows, quote, "The first and most important task for the analyst is to create a stable, trustworthy connection based on a human bond. Through this, the patient may acquire the opportunity to encounter or re-encounter a living human being within themselves, an experience that can help them remember or develop their own humanity." And then, in a wonderful comment of understatement, you finish the sentence by saying, "This is not an easy process." It is indeed not an easy process. And you talk about how the analyst has to tolerate being dehumanized just as the patient felt dehumanized in their own development. Tell us more about this. Give us a feel for what that's like.
I usually make an analogy that I'll repeat here in this talk to you. Let's say that we are in a very hot day. In Brazil, now we're getting to the summer and we get really hot days. And the heat is so much that menace the life of the people. So let's suppose that suddenly a swimming pool appears. And everybody would like to jump into the swimming pool for the refreshment. And people will do that, in my example. But the majority of the people that jumped in, after feeling refreshed, will move on. They will get off the pool and move on. The addict will remain at the bottom, but with the feeling that it's good there, so they don't want to face life the way it is anyway. So if you want to treat a person that's in the bottom of the pool, you have to jump in and go to the bottom and feel the pain and the situation from the patient points of view, and feel the pain as well. So in this situation where pain meets, there's a hope that this do can begin to be constructed.
And there is also a moment which is so special, which is when an addict stops using the substance and starts to dream again. I think that this is, during a therapy, this is such a joyful moment. Do you agree, José?
I agree. Very much.
And you mean literally dream, not just metaphorically dream.
No. Yeah, because the addiction also impairs the dreaming possibility. And so, I mean, literally. And so when patients start to bring dreams again, this is a very good prognostic sign.
It's a good sign, yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. And on the other hand, I as an analyst, and I think you too, we have the signs that we are entering an addiction world, because sometimes you begin to feel bored in front of the patient.
Mm-hmm.
You begin to feel somnolent in front of the patient. And it's almost like you couldn't control yourself. And if you don't notice that that's a message that you're entering the addictive world, you miss the chance to talk with the patient about this feeling. Because it's very important that you say what you're feeling, and the patient will recognize that you are getting close and together.
The example you give is not simply of boredom, but let me read your clinical example. You write, "In fact, on several occasions, I felt I had lost confidence in my abilities to treat her. The feeling was terribly unpleasant. On one particular difficult day for me, I commented on the feeling of discomfort I sometimes felt when we were together. Surprisingly, she smiled and responded with a certain air of triumph. Patient says, 'That's life, doc. You got it. This is the way I feel all the time.'" And that's that projective communication where we take on the patient's experience, and that, like boredom, allows us to enter their world. With all the pain that's associated with.
Yeah, I agree. That's at the same time a difficulty. But when seen only as difficulty, we might lose the opportunity to enter the patient's world, because it's like a door opening for this contact, this intimate contact that we need to have with our patients. So if you see that as something bad, and you don't go for this shared experience, it's a pity, because that's the only way you can get close to an addictive patient.
Without at all minimizing, and I don't think you are, how troubling it can be to be pulled into that world. However much we may be able to step out of it and observe how useful it is for the patient and for both of us and for the work we're in, it is, as you indicate, a very disconcerting experience for the analyst to have.
It is. It is. Exactly. That's why many analysts prefer not to enter the door and say, I'm not feeling good. I want to stay away from this awful feeling, because it's awful. And it's not a matter of being in and out, because sometimes you see a patient with any addictive problem, and it takes a while, it may take days for you to get out of that that type of relationship with life. So you do have, sometimes you have to make an effort to come back. We do come back, but it's very hard. The bottom thing is that it takes time. It takes time for leaving the addictive axis and reaching the dependence axis, as I say in my work. It takes time. So it's very disturbing. And if you get scared, you won't go through that door anymore. You won't do it. You get away from your patient.
Well, is it more correct to say if you get scared and only feel scared? Because I think feeling scared is appropriate. It's just what we do with it.
If you get scared and you don't get curious.
Right. Yeah.
You don't get it.
Well, let me ask you both. How do we take what we're talking about and apply it not to the patients who are able to come to analysis, but to the patients who, let's say, come less often, come, let's just pick once a week as a commonplace frequency that most of the world, especially the addictive world, are able to access? How do we use what we're describing and bring it to benefit that treatment?
Well, I don't know if Claudia wants to say something, but I think we have to take any opportunity we have. And I'll quote Claudia's paper, because she says that the fact that both leads to one's impossibility to tolerate intimacy. Impossibility is strictly connected to a process of dehumanization and a desire to humiliate, hurt, damage, and be cruel to one's own sexual object. If you're seeing a person once a week, if you can show what the person is doing to you, because for the person, it's like he or she wasn't there at all. It's not a matter of seeing the person once a week, because you may see a person once a week and the person is very grateful to be with you. But sometimes the person is using you as an addictive object. And it makes a lot of a difference if you can tell the person what the person is doing to you. Because then the person will realize that he or she exists, and it makes a difference when she treats the world in a good way, or if she's treating the world in a way that the world won't want the person in the world. That's what the person feels. There's no place for me there, so I'll go to pornography, I'll take drugs, I'll do more exercise, I'll do things that depend exclusively on myself, and I won't care for others. So you have to say, you do matter, and it matters the way you treat me, because I can't feel good or bad when I'm close to you. So you do have an influence in this treatment.
You know, I'm so interested with what you said, Claudia. Let me just add this, and then I'll ask you to say, you use the word grateful to distinguish the patients who are really present with you. And I recently had a conversation with Heinz Weiss, a German analyst who treats troubled patients. And he focuses on that very same point. The capacity to feel grateful is a capacity to be related. He uses a Kleinian notion of reparation, of course, but grateful is something we can all relate to. We know what it feels like to feel it towards others, to receive it from others, and we know how different it is when we're being talked at and treated, as you say, as a dehumanized entity. And so analysts from around the world are all approaching these troubled, traumatized patients in our own languages, from our own syndromes, but we're finding the same kind of phenomena. And perhaps with the three of us, for example, speaking, South America, the States, and Europe, we can start finding a common language. And let me not get in the way of your thoughts, Claudia.
No, I was just saying that I agree with Jose, of course, and he has a lot of experience in this field. And also he had the privilege to work with Kantian, who has been a great thinker in the area of addiction. But what I want to say is that, yes, the problem is to find the balance with the capacity of the patient to tolerate intimacy. Because it is sometimes difficult to be too close to them, and it is difficult to be too distant. And so, I mean, this is of course with all patients, but with addicts, it has it brings into a very special problem about the possibility to be to keep the right distance. And I think this is very important. And I was also thinking about gratefulness and intimacy. A young patient of mine who just yesterday thinking to the next holidays, and she was saying, "This is the only thing in my life I have. Just start stopping drugs and having only the analysis. You know, the possibility to meet someone and to talk openly about." Hair pain. So I think a lot of part of the problem of treatment with addicted patient is this closeness to them, which is somehow even more difficult than with other patients.
Hmm. So in a sense, what I hear you both saying is that, while frequency is helpful, the real determining factor is the analyst's ability to be present and to appreciate the patient's need to be present and absent, and the developmental struggles for them that represents.
Well, no doubt about that. You see, when we talk about pornography, there's also something interesting. That's the person is seeing a scene that's in front of the person. And it's like the person wasn't there, because he isn't really. He isn't, or she isn't, he or she isn't. They're not there. They're watching something that's happening in front of them, but they're not there themselves. And I remember some dreams. There's an instrument of some dreams that we recur to when we're very anguished, that we get off the scene and we get to a position to see the scene, but you're not there in the scene anymore. And that's what I think happens with pornography all the time. The person sees the scene, doesn't have a story. He got in the middle of the stuff. He sees the scene, the sexual scene. And that's very exciting because he's safe. He's not there. He's not there. And I think that it's very important for the person to realize that the person is there in the scene with you. Otherwise, he'll watch the scene as he or she weren't there at all.
And that's the life struggle that Claudia wrote about, and you both written about. That's the life struggle that enables intimacy, it enables creative sublimations, and makes life worthwhile, yeah?
Yeah.
About the scene, I would like to add this, that in pornography, the problem is that, as I was saying before, there is this theme of passivity. And there are, of course, on the internet, thousands and thousands and thousands of scenes. And each person is looking for that scene that meets his internal needs. And this is the point that one thing is if you actively create a scene in your mind which you find exciting, and the other thing is if you go on the internet and you look for a scene which is created by someone else and usually created in a way which is banal, which is which is responding more to market characteristics and features than your own, what you really need. And so I think that there is a discrepancy between what you really need and what you find on the internet. It is a kind of spoiled image. It's not really yours. It's something that someone else, the market, and the power of the internet is offering to your eyes.
And what you've both made clear is the remedy, the counterweight to that dehumanization is a living humanization in the clinical setting, whether it be an analytic setting or a psychotherapy setting. The alternative to discover their new creative energies and to also to reflect on what went awry in their development, that depends upon the analyst's ability to bring themselves to the encounter with the patient, which you both describe so beautifully in each of your chapters. I want to thank you both. I have learned a great deal from reading your work. I am going to continue to learn a great deal as I continue to read your work because, again, you're both coming at it and you're finding your own nuance to it. And I appreciate it. I'm confident our listeners will share that sense of learning from you both. And as I've mentioned, we've talked earlier on podcasts, and I look forward to our having future conversations. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Harvey. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Harvey. Thank you, José.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.